So, Eri Brown, you and I have literally watched this industry reinvent itself multiple times in the time that we've been working together. I think that we first started working together nearly 30 years ago.
We did. It has been a very long time. I was not going to admit the actual years, but yes, it's been 3 decades. It's been great.
I was thinking about the things that were different then when we first started working together and how they are now. But before I do that, because I think there have been some amazing changes that we've all witnessed, can you just give our listeners, which are other B2B marketers, normally from North America, a little bit of a
potted history of your career to date? Because there's some big names in there, some big experiences, and I'd love to be able to share those with our listeners. Sure, yes, I'm happy to. I have had, as you said, 30 years in tech. It has spanned 30 countries around the world as well. It's kind of strange to think about that when the world was much more global and dynamic in the sense of PR. It has spanned a lot of the tech industry, from chips and motherboards and big enterprise hardware systems to consumer tech, online fashion styling, and media. And now I'm at a software company designed for the cloud. And so when I think about this history of 30 years, it does have some big brands like Yahoo and NetApp and Microsoft and Skype. And I started off at Sun Microsystems, which is now part of Oracle. And so it has been quite a ride. There have also been some startups that have done some niche things. Some have been wildly successful. Some have been a lot of fun, but it's been a great learning experience for all 3 decades.
And so I was talking to our producers about you as a guest beforehand, and it's so exciting that we've got Eric coming on, because when I first came to order B2B PR,
the name Eric Brown carried such weight, because at that time, there were very few people who had the kind of budget and power to, on a global basis, to appoint agencies. And I think all of London wanted to work for you and wanted to work for NetApp, as it was at the time.
That was something that I realized was going on around the world. You had similar contacts to me all across North America, Asia, Australia, and you brought us all together.
So one of the first questions I wanted to ask, because there'll be many people that are listening to this that are looking at ways in which you can build a global PR network.
How did you approach that? Because there's obviously lots of different choices, global agency networks, independent boutiques. What was your, at the time, how do you evaluate those different options?
I think I was really fortunate at NetApp. When I joined the company, it was $400 million in revenue. By the time I left, it was $4.5 billion in revenue. And the growth journey of NetApp was tremendous and amazing. And the executives were smart and ambitious and really empowered the marketing team and the communications team to do a lot of net new stuff that the company had never done before. And we were going rapidly around the world. We looked at a regional agency model with a head agency and then subs or affiliates under that. So Europe, Asia, Southern Hemisphere, North America. And we looked at just thinking about a global agency. And what I really still believe in is that if you can afford it in terms of budget and if you can afford it in terms of time to go for the best agency and the best team in every country. And that's because there are so many things that are truly global and international. Technology is global and international, but human relationships and news stories and media coverage, whether it's earned media or social media or blog content, those things are very local, and people really care for a local angle on a technology story. And so the only way you can get a truly local angle in the UK is if you have an agency in the UK. And that's the same for France and Germany and every country I've done PR and comms around the world. And so for me, country by country is the best beta dog.
And so if I was a B2B marketer in North America listening to this and thinking, okay, so here's Eric, he's been there, he's done that, he's got the t-shirt. And here's Eric advocating for a local agency, a best of breed network model. How would you recommend balancing the advantages that you've just discussed, that you've described, against, I mean, there's some very good global agencies with local offices in each market.
Talk to me about how you evaluate that dilemma, because it is a dilemma that I think everybody is faced with.
Right. I think the dilemma really comes down to, it's less budget, because the global agencies will charge just as much as 10 different agencies for 10 different countries in the end. I think it comes down to the bandwidth that different countries around the world are supported with content approvals, with spokespeople, with customer case studies, with local survey data or local economic data or local trend analysis. And if you don't have an in-house team who is committed to making all of that happen, then you may as well go with the global agency model. And what they will do is take your generic North American content and find a way to slightly localize it. But I don't think it's nearly as deep or as robust or as rich as if you go country by country and find a team really dedicated to that. And in every service industry, and comms is still very much a service industry, it is not a commodity, despite what the AI bots and other people would have us believe. Service industries are all about individuals and the people who are working on your account. And I have yet to meet a big global agency who is consistent around the world. And that's why I think the country by country model is superior.
Obviously, AI is changing everything. But I look back to when we first started working together. I was thinking about the media landscape that we were trying to engage with when we first started working together 30 years ago. And it's predominantly print, a smattering of broadcast, but predominantly print. The business and national press were like the tier one golden media outlets. Trade publications were the bread and butter of everything that was going on. And there were these occasional things emerging just at that time, the occasional online piece of coverage. And I remember as an agency around that time, a big complexity that we had was clients not necessarily appreciating or valuing or knowing how to measure and evaluate and appreciate online coverage. And of course, that's changed because it's become completely normal now. And we stand at another threshold, which is the advent of AI as a means for B2B buyers to discover and validate purchasing decisions. So in a way, it's gone full circle. We're at the same point whereby when we first started working together, I think the executives that we were all dealing with didn't really know the value of a blog, didn't understand the value of a piece of online coverage, were very much more familiar with a cutting from the Financial Times or the Times or something on the BBC. And part of our collective job was often to show the value of computing or Computer Weekly or whatever the vertical sector publications were. So you've been through this process of having to re-educate the board as to the power of third-party endorsement, albeit in a different environment. And now here we are again. You're having to do the same thing again. Can you talk me through some of the challenges and lessons that you learned the first time around and how you might be applying that to the environment that we're in now?
Absolutely. I think the key lesson that I still believe in is that a good story grabs attention. And whether that story is told on TikTok or in the Financial Times or the BBC, a good story grabs attention. And so the role of comms people, really good strategic comms people to me, is to find the stories that resonate and use data and use AI to help you research and make recommendations, but then put a human touch on it, find a compelling spokesperson, find a great anecdote. Our brains have evolved to want a narrative structure. And the more you can make your story a narrative as opposed to a list of facts, the more you can make your story have a human element, the more you can tie it to what's going on. We have seen over these 30 years we've worked together a dramatic shift in where stories can live. What we have not seen fundamentally is what makes a compelling story. And so before I even think about who's going to write it, is it going to be earned? Is it going to be on the blog? Is it going to be something we pay for? Is it going to be a video? Is it going to be audio? Is it just going to be a straight up press release? What are the story elements? And how do we create some sense of plot and interest, just as a novelist would, because that's what really gets attention.
You've been in this world where we went from number of clickings, that's probably the first measurement that we ever dealt with, due to things like advertising value equivalent was a big trend in terms of measurement. But how do you educate the board when you are the senior comms person of a B2B brand in North America? What metrics do you think need to be in place?
The key measurement for me on a daily basis is share of voice, or I should say on a monthly basis. And I look at share of voice in two different ways. I look at share of voice in terms of share of voice in the number of clips. I also look at share of voice in terms of the number of potential audience, because obviously a clip in the BBC or a clip in the Register is going to have a larger audience than a clip in some very niche publication. Aside from share of voice, I think the holy grail, if you were, is what type of coverage correlates with increased web traffic? What type of coverage correlates with decreased cycle times to go from a first touch to an MQL, to an SQL, to a closed one, and really putting the data systems in place to measure how all of that happens.
So how do you go about convincing and educating the board? Because something that you've always been very good at, and something that I've seen time and time again, and I think really marks you out as being somebody that's been very successful in this global comms role, has been your ability to connect the mayhem and chaos and unpredictability of what's going on in the world of PR to the need for predictability at board level. I've always seen you as being somebody that bridges the gap between those two environments particularly well. And there's going to be people listening to this that have got that challenge of a board of directors that are maybe the economic buyers that don't really understand what's going on in the UK, don't understand what PR is, and don't understand how to measure it, but have got a feeling that they should be doing it. So what advice would you give to somebody in that position in terms of how to go about educating the board so that they appreciate and understand and continue to invest in PR as a strategy?
Most boards, whether it's a massive company, and I've worked for some of the biggest in the world, or a startup, really care about return on investment. And so finding a way to demonstrate that your investments in communications, your investments in storytelling, your investments in reputation management, your investments in media relations and the blog and social media have a return. The best returns that they want are faster sales cycles, bigger average deal sizes, more search volume. And there's also, I think, especially in technology, a real sense of the technology industry being very close-knit. And there are so many people who see each other on a regular basis, even in a distributed world. We're at the same tech conferences. We're talking about the same vendors. The VC community is still in Sand Hill Road here in Silicon Valley. And I like to make sure that the coverage that we generate from a publicity program or on LinkedIn or on some other network also reaches the investor community, whether it's a VC or an institutional investor or somebody on a board of directors. They by and large are reading a certain class of news. They're reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or looking at their peer networks on LinkedIn. They are not reading the techie niche industry specific things that a lot of our PR coverage is aimed at getting. And so making sure my comms teams and agencies and partners keep a steady drumbeat and keep a steady flow of news.
Okay. And so if you are based in North America and you've got a board of North American decision makers that you're having to sell into, and the UK has become an important or is an important market for you to expand into, which given the macroeconomics that are going on at the moment between Europe and the North American politicians, it is increasingly likely that the UK is going to become more important in terms of that journey. What are some of the misconceptions that you came across in various different roles? I don't want to talk about anyone specifically, but and because I'm sure there's many that you must come across when people are talking about the UK.
Well, I'll say that for most of the startups I've been at, the UK is the natural second stop, if you will, to market and sell. People start in the US as a US company. The UK is frequently the next country that Americans think about as an easier market to penetrate because of the language, because whatever you've coded, whether it's consumer tech or B2B tech, the interface is going to work. And the UK is also a very sophisticated IT market, as in lockstep with the US technology market as any other country in the world. I think the challenge that happens is that people think because of the language similarities and the business similarities and even the way our financial and legal systems are set up in very similar ways, that marketing to a UK audience base is going to be similar. And it's not. There was a time when an American CEO could say that he or she was going to be on a press tour and UK media would show up. And that's no longer the case. You need to have local data. You need to have local customers. You need to have a local spokesperson. Even if you're sending your CEO or CFO or head of product innovation, you need to have a local person with you.
I mean, I've never been on the front end of that part of the process to the extent that you have, in terms of having to sit down with the CEO of a multi-billion dollar global business and explain that this piece of editorial has got this comment in it that is a little bit bruising potentially, but you need to get over it because it's the register. The CEOs I speak to on that basis tend to already be British or be familiar with the environment. But people who are in your position, many of the people listening to this, may not have the luxury of having a CEO who understands the media landscape to that extent. And I imagine it can be quite shocking for a spokesperson to see that kind of underhand, dry sarcasm woven into editorial.
It absolutely can be a little shocking for them, especially if you've done a briefing over an afternoon tea or an early evening cocktail or at a breakfast briefing. Everybody seemed very happy and very friendly and upbeat. And then you see this article that kind of takes the piss. And some American executives don't know quite what to do with that. And what I find frequently is that if the executives do, not everybody in the rest of the marketing department does. I prefer not to do damage control. I prefer to do education in advance.
Brilliant. And that's a brilliant bit of advice for anybody who's about to start doing a PR campaign that comes across the UK. Thank you for that. And in terms of other cultural differences or things that B2B marketers need to be aware of if they're coming to the UK, other than their sort of snarky, cynical editorial environment, is there anything else that you've noticed that people should be aware of?
I think there is a real tendency for Americans to talk business all the time. And I tell people, if you're doing a briefing and it's via a telecom software, you have got to discuss something other than what's in your press release or what's on your press page. And Americans, I think, generally have a much higher tolerance of talking business nonstop. I find that we're the only culture in the world who has that tolerance. And so when somebody is spending time with you, spend time getting to know them as a person and don't just think of them as somebody else who is a vehicle for your pitch.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's particularly important for North American business leaders who are coming to the UK with a story to tell. There's a very fine line between being constructive, supportive, and informative, or being perceived as being arrogant and trying to tell the world how to run their business. And it can be quite difficult to navigate that. Probably more difficult for North American business leaders, given that North America is as dominant as it is. Did you ever run into any problems with any journalists or spokespeople whereby there was just a misunderstanding or a clash or any strange things happen?
Yes. Less in the UK, because as even though I said that UK journalists can have what I would call a slight cynicism or a bit of snark, they are also incredibly polite. And to an untrained observer, you might not even realize that they've said something a bit snarky. But I have had opportunities to be with CEOs in other countries around the world where journalists have said, well, I'd love to be able to write this. Can you give me 2,000 euros to do it? And that can take some CEOs by surprise. And then the CEO is looking at me like, I thought this was PR. And I said, well, yes, it's PR, but it's PR in country X. And in country X, it is okay to pay a freelancer for coverage.
Yeah, it does bear. And I think that talks to the first point that we raised, which is about the importance of having that localized approach as opposed to a globalized approach. Because we are finding that in certain regions, paying
in order to engage with the media outlets is vitally important and is done in such a way that it doesn't diminish the editorial credibility. In the UK, it's still not the case. It's earned media, paid media, or shared media. These are three very different environments. But in APAC, for example, what I've noticed is a real convergence of those environments, and they do feed off each other and work together well.
They do, absolutely. And I also, even in the US and the UK now, I don't tell people what they can or can't do, but I do try to say to my PR agency partners and to executives here, what outcomes do we want and what is the best way to achieve them with maximum ROI? And there are certain opportunities that I am very willing to pay for, and in terms of sponsored editorial or advertorial or a sponsored video on a particular media network, that are easier with a better ROI than trying to pitch earned coverage. And so I think that's another shift. 30 years ago, when you and I first started working together, there was a lot of integrity around getting earned coverage and advertising people or performance marketers. And these all days, separate. All completely separate and siloed. And now I need to get the story out. I need as many people who are in our ideal customer profile to read about us as possible. And how do we use every comms vehicle to do that, whether it's paid, earned, shared, or owned?
Interesting. And so if you were looking at the UK today from North America, and you had a B2B brand that you wanted to introduce into the into the UK, where would you start? What would be the first thing that you would, what would be the first few steps that you take in terms of assessing where to begin?
For me, reading the local coverage and actually actively seeking out what the UK press are writing about. And not just in terms of technology, but also in terms of politics and culture and society and the art scene. And that lets me know as much as I can from several time zones away what the cultural texture is at the moment, what the political texture is at the moment. Then like to look at what competitors are doing in that market, and they actually have local content, local customers, local partners, local reseller partners, and if I can find out who the competitors are using in terms of a PR agency or a marketing consultancy.
I love that, because your whole philosophy, your whole approach, I think this says so much about how you have been so successful, Eric, but there's such respect for the market built into your philosophy, because it's about listening, learning, understanding, and then acting once you know what's going on. And I think that's so important. Certainly journalists pick up on that. Cynical British journalists will see that. Local case studies, local data points, localized spokespeople, if possible, but not necessary. But just having that local expertise, and that starts with what you just said, which is understanding the market, understanding the players, what's working and how and why. And I think that foundation of empathizing with the market permeates everything else that you do. But I see many brands skip that part. And I think that they do that at their peril, because you end up with that monolithic, generic kind of messaging set and strategy that doesn't allow for adaptations or nuances on a local basis. So I think that's really great advice as well. There's lots of good stuff here for people to unpack. Now, in terms of some last questions, these are questions that I ask everybody during these podcasts. Can you tell me your favorite business book?
Oh, my favorite business book is still Crossing the Chasm. It's an oldie but a goodie. And I look at different technology companies I've been at, and I think, okay, are we still to the left of the chasm? Are we in the chasm? Are we going to get out of the chasm? Are we going to early mainstream? How do we get to Main Street? I think, Crossing the Chasm, absolutely. Far and away, all these decades and years later.
Yeah, fantastic. And what about, are there any media that you consume regularly that you think a good tip for anybody in the B2B marketing role in North America?
I am a news junkie, and I read a lot of different news sources on a daily basis. I live not far outside of Washington, D.C. Washington has one of the best papers in the world, in the Washington Post. I read the Washington Post every day. I read CNBC every day. I check out CNN and the New York Times and Reuters and Bloomberg. And I also make sure that I keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening at the Register and BBC Online. And I look at, because we have a big development center in India with a lot of employees in India for the company I work for now, Aviatrix. I also make sure that I'm doing a weekly check, not a daily check, but a weekly check on what the tech press is writing about and the business press.
I mean, I've seen you in operation with Global Grid that are wrapped around the world, and I'm sure that you pay the same amount of attention to each region as you just described. But I imagine that part of the job has become a lot easier with the advent of the internet than it was when everything was in print way back when. It's never been more easy than it has become these days, but it's still very important. And I think that sometimes when things become very easy, they get forgotten.
Yes, I think you're right. One of the things I'm loving most about AI is being able to ask an AI agent to give me an analysis of what's been going on in the tech press in whatever dimension. Just the other day, we announced a partnership with Wiz, and I wanted to know, before we even announced our partnership, I wanted to know what they had been getting coverage for, who was writing the most about them, and where they were getting coverage that was not related to the planned Google acquisition of Wiz. And AI gave me in 20 seconds what it would have taken me half a day of manual research to
at
do.
At least half a day. Probably you could have paid thousands of pounds for that, actually.
Yes, completely. And relatively easy thing to do now, if you say, I am working on a launch in the UK or a launch in France or Germany or India or Spain. There are tools now so that research is relatively easy. The translation from other languages into English is also much more robust than it used to be. And so if you are a quality marketer or comms person and you are not spending some time on researching markets you want to enter, you're not doing your job.
So the three lessons, tell me if there's any more that I should be highlighting. That number one, if you're a B2B marketer coming to the UK, prepare your spokespeople for a more cynical environment whereby there could be a degree of cynicism or sarcasm that they may not be accustomed to, and make sure they don't take that personally. The other point that I think that came across very loud and clear from you was the importance of localized content. So data point, haste buddy, anecdote, experiences, but insight are local. The other thing that comes before all of this that I think is a lesson is just understand the market. Tap into what's going on culturally in the news agenda. What are competitors doing? What's working for competitors and what's not? Then build a view from there. And then the fourth lesson, which is probably the most current, is use AI to delve into the research, the hypothesis, to test, to research what's going on and to make sure that you've got all that information as you do your planning.
I think you nailed those four. I would add just a fifth, which we did not talk about in this conversation, but that I know we've talked about over the years we've known each other. And that is, find partners you can have fun with and from whom you can learn. I think I am constantly looking for people who teach me things and for people who stretch my imagination and people who can make me laugh, because the industry that we are in is very stressful and very tense, and it's very public. I mean, it's even in the name, public relations. Everything we do is visible to the world, and that comes with a lot of scrutiny. And from a PR professional to a PR professional, we have got to be able to enjoy the time together, because there will be articles that are great and there will be articles that will be horrible, and there will be news cycles that move our companies or our clients forward, and there will be news cycles that do just the opposite. And having a partner who is amazing and fun and trusted is really, really important.
There we are. Five brilliant lessons from the brilliant Eric Brown.
Oh, well, you're very kind. You are one of the most inspirational PR and comms and marketing leaders I've ever worked with. And we've worked together with so many clients. And for all of them, you and your team have delivered. And I have learned and grown as a professional because of you. And so I'm very grateful.